Allison Carter with the Milestones Podcast. This is episode 60, and today I have an interview show for you with a speech and language pathologist. She will be discussing different ways to support communication with young children. I hope you enjoy the show. All right, today I have Ayelet Marinovic. She is a pediatric speech language pathologist, parent educator, singer, and mother based in the San Francisco Bay Area. She is the creator of Strength in Words, whose mission is to promote caregiver and baby interaction and support parent education through music, play, sensory experiences, and language-rich environments. Her current passions include spending time with her family and creating a community of support for families of young children with infants and toddlers of all developmental levels. So, welcome, Ayelet.
Hello. Thanks for having me, Austin.
Thanks for being on. So, do you want to, let's get started today talking a little bit about how to support early communication with our families.
Sure. So, excuse me. There are, of course, a lot of ways to do that.
Yes.
I'll start with just the fact that really when we talk about, you know, the ways that infants and toddlers communicate, obviously there's a broad spectrum because the first 3 years are the period in which we develop language. And it's quite amazing. And I like to start by sort of delineating the difference between those three terms of speech, language, and communication.
Okay.
Where communication is sort of that overarching, the umbrella term that includes both the motoric aspect of actually forming sounds and words, and also the linguistic aspect of, you know, vocabulary, putting words in sentences in a grammatically correct way, as well as things like the pragmatics or social communication piece of, you know, knowing how quickly to speak or how loudly to speak or how closely to another person we should be speaking.
Mm-hmm.
And then in addition to all those things, the nonverbal parts of communication, which of course, those last few things touch on, but also things like gesture, eye gaze, and facial expression, and all of those other things, tonality of our speech, you know, the intonation, that all inform the ways, not only what we're communicating, but the ways in which we're communicating. And of course, the manner in which our very, very young children learn to do all of those quite complex things
Yes.
is through observation, imitation, and interaction primarily. And so how do we support an infant or toddler's early communication development? Well, primarily through daily routines and caregiving routines and play routines. And when I say routines, I really mean sort of that ritualistic, repetitive thing that happens all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So things like diaper changes or bathing or, you know, feeding, whether you're nursing your baby or feeding a bottle or sitting later at the table, all of those things happen multiple times throughout the day, every day. And we can capitalize on them by creating specific things that happen in a certain order, by adding, you know, fun or playful aspects to them, like little songs or little phrases that we always say. And oftentimes we're already doing these things without even thinking about it. And that's sort of the real key piece here is that we're already, most of the time, we're already very, very close to doing everything that we should be and that we can be to supporting our infants and toddlers naturally. And I think there's this, you know, the baby industry, quote unquote, would have us believe that we need all of these things to help our children to develop, right? To buy learning toys. Right. And of course, right. Like there's wonderful play materials out there. There are also horrible play materials out there that are marketed as quote unquote learning toys. And most of them are the ones we do not even want in our house because they are loud. They are noisy. They have bright lights. And you know what? They are not teaching your child anything except one specific thing, which is cause and effect, which of course is a wonderful skill to learn, but your kid's going to learn that anyway.
Right.
Right. Right. When you turn the light on and it goes on and then you turn it off, that's another great way to teach cause and effect, right?
Yes.
Light switch goes on, light goes on. And so you don't need a keyboard that does not actually, you know, make a piano sound, but it makes some bizarre animal noises and whatever.
Right.
I'm not even going to go into it.
Right. And it's all...
But
it's,
that's not... yeah.
Go ahead.
Those
I was
are not
say.
The things...
It's also just
Go
not
ahead,
functional.
Yeah.
I mean, these weird sounds that don't mean anything and don't make sense with what it is.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. If they're out of context, there's no reason why. I mean, I think obviously they're taking basically like toys like that often like to take all of the things that, you know, someone in that company has read that, oh, developmental research supports the use of environmental sounds like animal sounds and music and all of those things. And they've created this monstrosity that does everything. And here, if your child plays with this, then they're going to have everything. But the problem is, of course, they've approached the entire thing backwards, right? So tear it down. Take out the noisy toys. Don't subject yourself to that. There's no need.
Yeah. So can you talk about some of your favorite developmental toys?
Oh, gosh, yes. So honestly, the things that I tend to give my friends who are new parents are things like, I like to give them household items with like little tags that give very specific ways that like, here are some ways that you can play with these to support your baby's development. And I actually have some that I've developed like for a 1-year-old's birthday, and you can find those on my website if you're interested. But basically, so when you present your young child with objects, they're most likely going to be most interested in things that are already in your house, right? So some of my favorite things are empty egg cartons, because these are wonderful things that you can open and close. You can put things inside. You can experiment with the size and shape. When a baby is starting to actually look at things and remove things or take them in and out, you can have them, you know, play with those things. And it's all about, you know, size and shape and weight, experimentation. You can sort little things inside by color. You can put objects inside that, you know, make sound like an egg shaker, for instance, or, you know, one of those plastic Easter eggs that you close, make sure is nice and closed and put some rice in it or something. Like, there you go. Voila. A DIY egg shaker. Right. And there, like things like that. There's obviously, you can find wonderful ideas like that from blogs that are all over Pinterest, but, I like to, you know, pare it down to little things like that. So you've got, you know, and there are wonderful things that you can do with something that opens and closes, like play with the vocabulary, right? There's a wonderful song, Open, Shut Them, right? Mm-hmm. Which you can just sing to your baby, right? Open and shut it while you're singing. Open, shut that, open, shut it. Or when your baby is opening and shutting it, sing the open when she opens it, and then sing the shut when she shuts it. And that's another wonderful way to help learn about cause and effect, right? As well as you're having this wonderful back and forth. You're playing with music. You're playing with vocabulary. And oftentimes when we sing or use music with our young children, it actually helps them. It helps gain their interest and keep their attention on something because it's new and it's different and it's somehow interesting because we're suddenly singing, which we don't usually do in conversation, right?
Right.
And when
you
play with the words of a song or you play with the interaction, then it's suddenly very, you know, it helps them attend because they're really curious and they want to listen to your voice. And this goes for anyone. You don't have to have a fancy, nice, pretty voice. They've been listening to your voice since, you know, before birth. moms. And and they your voice represents comfort and love. And if you really just don't want to sing, that's okay too. You can play with things like rhythm, and meter, right? I mean, nursery rhymes are a great example of that too. So, but okay, back to the actual objects of play. Okay. So,
an
egg carton is a favorite. Another favorite is a mirror, which of course you can have a handheld mirror. It's a great way to play peekaboo. You can have a mirror that's attached to the wall, whether it's a small little tile that you can get, say, from IKEA, or a big wall mirror that's attached to the wall. All of those, you know, that you put down at, you know, baby's height. Those are great ways to, or even a lot of these great little books, end in a mirror, right?
Yes.
Like, look, you know, can you look for a, you know, where's the dog? Oh, there he is. Where's the baby? Oh, there it is. Where's my baby? And then there's a mirror at the end, right? Those are great kinds of books that, of course, that capitalize on the use of a mirror. But you don't need a nice book. It's a wonderful thing to have and to invest in. But but I'm suggesting that all you need is the actual mirror.
Yes, right.
And you can do the same thing with just the mirror.
And there's a lot of also a lot of infant mirrors people have in their cars when the kids are rear facing or and you can move those out of the car and bring them in the house too and use them on the floor.
Exactly. Yeah, no reason for them to. I mean, obviously it's more convenient to keep it where it is because it's usually the kind of thing that moves and then you get it in exactly the right spot and then somehow it moves out of that spot all the time. So those kinds of things are great to have. And if you are, you know, in a play routine, right, like a peekaboo thing, if you just have a mirror in the hallway, that's a great thing to do and to to have your child experiment with the way his body moves, play peekaboo or just greet themselves. I have a hilarious video of my own older son when he was a toddler starting to speak and experiment with his movement of him just like walking down the hall and just saying hi to himself and putting his head between his legs and looking at him. I mean, it's just, there's so many playful, wonderful, hilarious things that they can do. And when you can also involve yourself in that, then it's an interactive experience and it's hilarious and it's sweet and it's supporting the social and emotional piece as well, right?
So exactly.
There's no end in that. So, and I want to just say on that subject is that, again, when we're talking about how to support early communication in infants and toddlers, we are also talking inherently about how to support social emotional development, cognitive development, and motor development, and probably adaptive skills as well, right? These are all very, very, very linked, especially in those first few years. Infants and toddlers learn holistically. You can't separate one domain or part of development from another. I mean, obviously, there are specific skills within each of those things, but when you are, quote-unquote, working on communication, you're also, and what that really means is when you're playing with your baby, you're also helping to support your baby's, you know, motor skills and cognitive skills, especially when we're talking about things like vocabulary, right? Vocabulary, especially when you have things like opposite words, right? On and off, for instance, back to that light switch.
Mm-hmm.
That's a basic concept, right? The concept of something being on or off is they have to understand some semblance of that concept to actually use that vocabulary word or understand the word. So those are inextricably linked when you think about it. And then, of course, to have a child reach out and turn it on, right? That's your
motor.
And creating that pincer grasp to flip it on, maybe, you know, those are all very important little pieces that we are always supporting when we are interacting and providing those opportunities for imitation and for observation. So,
yeah. And if they're standing on the floor, depending on how tall they are, if they can reach up on their tiptoes or, you know, and try to, it's also a gross motor skill in that way.
Exactly. Yeah.
Overall development.
And then, to mention things like, you know, heavy work, right? I mean, like, another of my favorite things is a laundry basket, right? And whether that's a basket that's full of laundry that you're asking your child to help with by pushing down the hallway, hello, heavy work. Like, this is a great way for them to regulate their body and move with you and feel independent and feel helpful and be proud of what they're doing. That, like, all of those things, right? Like, it's so great. Or whether you are turning that empty laundry basket over and making it into a drum, where an infant who is often there, we see this sort of co-emergence of babbling and this sort of rhythmic banging or rhythmic movement of the hands, it often emerges simultaneously, which is great. So we can support our, you know, babbling 6 or 7 month old babies' early communication skills by giving them a drum to bang on. And of course, it doesn't need to be a drum. It can be an upside down laundry basket or a cardboard box or a chair. I mean, no end in sight of options for that. So, and then, of course, not filling it up, taking things out, you know.
Yeah. And I was thinking also with the drum, initially, I think drumming with your hand, just your hand on the object, but also to take it to the next step, you could add an item.
Add a tool.
Add a tool, add a wooden spoon or add a plastic spoon or something from your kitchen.
Yes, a whisk. Kitchen items are the next favorite. I mean, I don't know that I could separate just my favorite kitchen item because the whole kitchen is my favorite. That's the place to be, I think. For both my infant and toddler, or now toddler and preschooler, that's the only. The fact that the playroom is right next to the kitchen is no small mistake. Like, they are inextricably linked. They are the same place for them. but yeah, so things like mixing bowls and wooden spoons and whisks and those sort of barbecue or pastry silicone brushes, those are great. All of those things are just fabulous. Kitchen timers,
and
so just, many things that are already in our kitchen.
And early on, I mean, it's like you said, it's so important that they get the chance to watch. I mean, you as the parent are their model. So as you're doing the pretend play or whatever it is that you're doing with these ordinary everyday items, and maybe it's your natural routine. Maybe you're mixing up cookie dough in a bowl and they have their own bowl with whatever in it, and they're pretending or they're trying it too, and or they're helping you with yours. But all those things are just early imitation, which go a long way towards not only communication but all development as well. But
Exactly.
Largely communication.
Exactly. I also want to say that, I mean, obviously, at a certain point, we're going to see that imitation. But even before they are actually imitating mm-hmm. our use or our modeling of an item,
yep.
They are absolutely benefiting from having
just
their
watching
own,
you.
Mm-hmm. You know, whisk or whatever it is. Yeah, and using it and experimenting with it at their own level, right? Mm-hmm. Because, and I think we forget this so often as adults, and we approach play from this sort of preconceived notion of what play looks like, right? We think about play as sort of sitting down and playing a board game or organized play or cooperative play. And so it's hard to get out of that to before we did that, mm-hmm. right? So,
right.
So play is really just two people sitting or being together. That's it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? That's kind of it. And that togetherness, can look very different depending on the age and stage of the child. So if you have an egg carton or a cardboard box full of, you know, interesting items that already exist in your house, like coasters and, you know, maybe, you know, egg shaker or even a rattle, you know, things that are or are not actually geared towards your baby. Obviously, we want to look out for choking hazards, and these are all meant to be interactive things that you do with your child.
Mm-hmm.
But smaller objects that can fit, you know, in a cardboard box or an egg carton are interesting for your baby to explore. And whether that is imitating you or mouthing, putting it in their mouth or, you know, throwing it across the room or taking things out, obviously we don't necessarily want to show our child how to throw everything across the room, but we can shape that behavior into something, right? Oh, you want to mm-hmm. throw that? Okay, let's throw it into the box. Here, mm-hmm. we can throw it in or whatever it is. You know, your baby can play with wooden blocks. They might not be stacking the wooden blocks and building a tower, mm-hmm. but they are certainly playing with the wooden blocks, right? And that doesn't have to look like what we think it's supposed to look like. And that's the key, right? Because the way that they learn and experiment to play like that is by experimenting with those objects, learning about, by grabbing it and putting it in their mouth and shaking it up and down, how big they are, the shape of it, how heavy it is, all of mm-hmm. those sort of motor and sensory things that obviously you are very aware of, Allison.
Right.
That's the way that your baby is learning about an object. And then when you can add the vocabulary and that sort of the talk about, oh, you're shaking it. Oh, how does it feel? Up and down, up and down. Oh, is it heavy? How does that taste? Oh, you're putting it in your mouth. That looks pretty yummy. Mmm.
Mm-hmm.
That's how they get the language piece, right? By immersing them in a language-rich environment. So when we talk about, oh, you know, give your baby sensory experiences, we don't need to always create a, you know, Pinterest-worthy sensory bin. We can just offer our child a laundry basket. Mm-hmm. That's it. That's
right.
All they need. So
yeah, and to go
and
back,
us.
Just yeah, and us, yeah. We are very important to that as well as the parents. But I was gonna say to go back just for a second that, you know, mm-hmm. when you're talking about the blocks and stacking and these toys that are, like you said, things that we have a preconception of how they're supposed to play with them and what you're
right.
supposed to do with these objects. And it, not just the blocks, but anything.
Anything.
Even a bowl and a spoon. I mean, we mm-hmm. first we think scooping or stirring, and our kids, if you just hand those things to them, I don't know what they're going to do, and that's okay. That's what we want them to do. We want them to experience it without, and it's hard for parents sometimes and probably therapists too, because we kind of want to get in there and see what they can do or, you know, try this, but we kind of have to step back and say, let's just give it to them. Wait a minute. Let's just see what they do. And then let's do that. Yeah. And we can imitate what they're doing or, and also, like you said, the language, obviously at the same time, but what are they going to do with it part? Let's give them a chance to experience it and explore it and learn how they want to learn from it, and especially the very early years.
Oh, God, I could not agree more. And I think a lot of times as therapists, we are guilty of this, especially because maybe, especially with early, you know, infant toddlers with early intervention, maybe we really, really want them to get to that imitation piece, right? Maybe that's a goal on the child's, you know, therapy plan. But we have to remember what comes first, right? That developmental sequence is very important. So we can't just rush to, okay, hand over hand, you're going to imitate me now, right? Mm-hmm. No, that's not the way it goes. We have to see what they do, what they are doing, what their natural, you know, where they are, just like you said, Allison. And then we also have to remember what the research says. And some of the research indicates that children are going to imitate, from like something crazy like 6 months old, a typically developing infant is already starting to take into account the environment and the context and the information that they already have about an object and their experience with that object to decide whether or not something is in that zone of proximal development, whether something is worthy of imitating. So they deduce whether something is moderately difficult. They're not going to imitate us when something is too easy, and they're not going to do it when it is too hard. They are going to do it when it is just a little bit, just a little bit of a challenge. And that's something that they are already deciding. So we have to create a context wherein they are able to do that. So, you know, that takes a lot of talking to the parent or caregiver about what the child has been doing with an object, how they have been playing with it, where they have been playing with it, what they often do with something, what their interests are, right? And then including a lot of the things that are motivating for that child. So whether that child really loves listening to music or really loves playing with water or whatever it is, including those things sorry, I'm blanking on words to help them decide that it's worthy of trying. And then, of course, scaling down and making sure that it's not too hard, or sometimes scaling up and making sure it's not too easy. You know, and this goes, I think, a great example of this is when parents tell me, like, oh, well, I know he knows how to wave, but he doesn't do it on command. Like, he doesn't do it when I say hi. And oftentimes, they're showing me that in the middle of a conversation.
Right.
In the middle of...
it's like, well, it doesn't make sense.
Yeah, why the context isn't there? No one's coming or going. Like, why would he wave? Mm-hmm. Why? He has to, of course he knows. He knows actually more than you're giving him credit for, because he knows when is appropriate use of that. And right now is not an appropriate use of that. Now, if you, you know, grab the doll and have the doll appear and say, hi, and then have the doll disappear quickly and say, bye, then maybe you would have created a context for a greeting, for instance. But, you know, so we have to give them more credit sometimes than we come into the room with, wanting to give them.
Yes.
And they, because they have so much more than than often we give them credit for.
And a lot of times,
really important,
especially when kids are at this age where they're maybe not talking a lot yet, but they yeah. understand so much, and maybe they can't yeah. tell you, and maybe not always show you like that example, but they understand yeah. it, they get it, and that is also yeah. communication.
Hugely. Exactly. Yes.
So that receptive piece of it, which, you know, a mm-hmm. lot of people that are maybe don't know what that exactly is, or maybe you could explain that too. You know, mm-hmm. it's a huge part of learning and being able to communicate is understanding what other people are saying to you. So
yeah.
do you want to talk about that
exactly.
for a second?
Sure. Yeah. So, when we talk about language, we're talking about two, sort of a yin and yang of two separate pieces that of course influence each other. And one is receptive language or the understanding comprehension of language. And one is expressive language or the use, and expression of language. So, usually we will see infants and toddlers start to understand words, especially in context, before they're able to use them. So you might see your child, you know, you might say the word, you know, shoe, for mm-hmm. instance, and you might see your child look towards the shoe, or point at the shoe, or grab the shoe, right? And even if they can't actually say shoe, because their that fine motor task of sequencing and putting together the necessary sounds and getting the breath support and that, you know, putting the sound, the tongue at the right part of the teeth and then putting two sounds together, shoo, they're not there yet. But they mm-hmm. can understand when you say shoe, and they often will maybe even bring a shoe to you. If you say, oh, go get that shoe, or where's my shoe, right? You will often be able to recognize that they can see the shoe. They know what the shoe is. So how can we, you know, help to develop that? So giving a child multiple opportunities with a word in one particular context is hugely important, but then also giving a child access to that word in many different contexts and across environments and with many, many partners. So to capitalize on that shoe example, right, maybe that means in the house, you know, you always take off your shoes when you enter the house. And so maybe to call attention to that, you might say, oh, let's take off our shoes. Let's see, here are my shoes. Here are your brother's shoes. Let's put them in the closet. That's where the shoe goes. That's where the shoes go. And then maybe when you're at the park or the grocery store, you see, you know, a little girl running around with sparkly light up shoes, and you might point those out, or you might see that your child is looking at them or pointing to them. Oh, look at her shoe. Wow, that shoe sure is sparkly, or that is a very pink shoe, whatever mm-hmm. it is. And then across partners. Okay. So maybe, maybe with grandpa, you talk about his shoes and you have him tell your child about his shoe or whatever it is, you know.
Yep.
So this is how we give our children access to many, many different vocabulary words. Now, that was a very particular, you know, very involved, like we are going to focus on this vocabulary word, but I promise you that you are already doing this. Mm-hmm. Right? Many, yeah. many times we're doing this naturally. And this is, of course, why children are we often see first words that emerge expressively, words that are often nouns, that a child has lots of experience with in their home, or a daycare environment, for instance, right? Those are the words that we see them saying first. Mm-hmm. My first son's favorite thing to eat was a banana. And guess what his first word was? Banana. Mm-hmm. Right? Because he loves bananas. And that's a very motivating word for him. If he can ask me for a banana, he sure is going to. Yeah. So that's sort of how we do that. And that's how that develops.
So I have a question for you.
Oh, good.
The banana thing just sparked a question. So a lot of times when kids are first learning how to talk and maybe they see the banana. Now you're mm-hmm. a speech language pathologist, so you say banana. A lot of kids would say nana. I'm sure you've heard that lots. So what, talk us through a little bit about nana and what should parents do, because
if a
to
child
me,
is saying banana. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, they're saying
nana instead of banana. Yeah.
Right. And that's as much as they can do right now as far as their skill. But would you say to the parents, say nana, or would you encourage them to give them the right word? Yeah.
Right. Yes. This is such a good question. Mm-hmm. And one I have drilled into
I'm
my
sure.
own family.
This is why I'm asking you, because I know you
extent.
Have an opinion.
So when we talk about first words, we can count things like nana for a banana, or wawa for water, or bubba for bottle. A first word does not need to be, and often is not, an adult pronunciation of a word. What a first word does need to include is a very specific link between that sort of production of the sound and some sort of approximation to the actual adult, you know, production of the word mm-hmm. and the actual word. It should, you know, it's repeatable. You'll see them use it in often across contexts, environments, and partners, right, with lots of different people in different places. If there's a banana in the grocery store, they might say nana. Or if there's a banana at their dinner in the kitchen, they're going to say nana. And if there's if their nana or their grandma is holding a banana, they might also say nana. And she might think, oh, he's saying nana. which, of course, is wonderful. And you can say, yes, that's such a wonderful thing that he's starting to say those sounds, and how wonderful that you're also holding one of his favorite objects, which is a banana. And let's keep modeling all of those things and help him differentiate between a banana and a nana. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I would suggest that if your child is using the baby version of a word, that if you would like that child to be understood and to continue to emerge that word into an adult production of that word, then by all means, keep modeling banana. That's right. You found a banana. That's right. There's a banana. Oh, banana. You love bananas. And that's how they're going to eventually move out of nana into banana, right? With more exposure, more modeling, and more practice. Because as you said, they're just not quite there yet. We often see, I guess you could say, infantilized versions of a word, because mm-hmm. they're simpler productions, especially words that are what we call reduplicated sounds, right? So nana, banana. You're going to hear nana first instead of the banana, which introduces another sound, the b. Mm-hmm. I have a good example of when my son was probably about 18 months. he was often, he would put the end consonant at the beginning of a word. Mm-hmm. So hat would be ta, or he would, you know, he would switch up those sounds. Now that did not mean that he had a speech disorder at 18 months old. It just meant that he was a precocious 18-month-old who had a lot of vocabulary words and was still developing his motor skills to be able to produce clear speech, which mm-hmm. is totally normal. but he calls his, or the Serbo-Croatian word for grandfather in my husband's family is Dida. And my son was calling his grandfather Daddy. And he doesn't mm-hmm. call his dad Daddy. He calls him a different word, which is mm-hmm. Tata, which is also the Croatian word for dad. So we knew that he was not calling his grandpa Daddy. Mm-hmm. He was calling him Dida, but he was switching the vowels. Now, we knew this as his parents. I knew this as his yep. mother. And mm-hmm. his dad knew it because he knew that there was a difference between what my son was calling this very specific person, which was Dida. And he knew to call him Dida because we referred to him as Dida. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't the same word as dad, as papa. But the grandparents didn't quite get that. They couldn't take that leap of understanding that actually he was trying to say Dida. And if you, and so he, they were saying, oh, wow, that's so cute. Like, oh, daddy, let's have him call him that. But maybe that's his word for his Dida. Mm-hmm. Now, I totally get the idea that like, oh my gosh, it's so sweet. It's so cute. We want to like keep these wonderful, sweet sounding infant words. I get, there are certain words that I just can't bear to let my infant or toddler go. So I will continue like modeling the correct pronunciation, but I'm not gonna, you know, number one, never, please don't say, no, you're not saying it right. It's this, right? That's mm-hmm. not what we do. mm-hmm. Because we want to motivate them to actually use words.
Yes.
But what we can do is continue to model the correct word. So when my son was saying Dudi instead of Dida, I was quite insistent that we continue to model the correct word and the mm-hmm. correct, you know, production of that word instead of accept that this was just his version of it. Well, no, it's his version of it because that's all he can do right now. If we want him to continue calling his grandfather Daddy, then mm-hmm. sure. But I don't want that.
So and I don't basically think any of yeah, all of yeah. all of the adults should get on board and continue yes. to say it the correct way.
Yes, that's the yes. short answer. Thank you.
Yeah.
Sorry. My long-winded example and explanation. Yes.
No, it's a good explanation.
If you want thank you. If you want your child to continue, because it's an emergence, right? It's the spectrum of ability. Just like everything else in parenting and in development, it is a skill that is on a continuum of emergence. Mm-hmm. So a child might start to say a word one way and then move through, and you might hear several different versions of that word, and it might change a little bit as it emerges, and then finally one day they'll just wake up and mm-hmm. and say it correctly, and you'll say, oh my god, where did my baby go?
I think you know, people can maybe think of it in a way of like a gross motor skill when, you know, babies yeah. are first starting to from being on their tummy when they're starting to scoot, and they're starting to mm-hmm. kind of do a little scoot forward, and then they get into maybe a kind of an army crawl, and they progress yeah. through to pushing up onto their hands and knees and starting to crawl hands and knees. You know, that's mm-hmm. that in a sense is the same thing. I mean, it's maybe a little easier because you can visually see it happening. So maybe yeah. that can help people understand that, it starts out one way and it doesn't, yeah. it continues and it progresses and it changes over time with practice and repetition and just time and a chance to do it and learn the skill and continue to get better at it.
Exactly. Yes, so. That's exactly it. Yeah. It's an immersion. That's all I can say. It's just all skills, all early developing skills are like that. And all skills for all of us, right? I mean, it's not like the first time you or I try to do something new, we get it right the first time, right? Oftentimes, and this goes for words too. If you are reading a word that aloud that you've never said before out loud, you're probably not going to say it right. Mm-hmm. Even if you said it right inside your head. And this is another thing, right? This is when we get into things like literacy. I mean, this is a whole other bag of worms later down the line, right? Is that we might rehearse a word inside our head and hear it and think we're going to say it. But then the way that we sequence the word when we produce it might not match that. So we need practice with words too. I mean, an example is my name, right? When yes. you first saw my name written, you didn't know how to pronounce it. And then you needed a few times to say it out loud to say it correctly. So
yes.
we all and do that. And I think we have to remember that our children need that too. And
yes.
we don't remember how hard it is because we don't have as many experiences with new words unless we're learning a new language, for instance, as we did when we were young. So it's hard for us to get inside their head and remember that, oh, that's hard. So let me give him more opportunities. Let me give him more practice with this. And we also want to remember, lastly, that as far as intelligibility or the degree to which we can expect our children to be fully intelligible or understood, by age three, they're only supposed to be, quote unquote, supposed to be about 80% intelligible to an outside listener, someone who's not familiar, a partner who's not familiar in conversation. And that when they're 50% intelligibility index, right? So by the time your child is two, someone who is not familiar with them is really only supposed to be able to understand 50% of what they say. So if your child is full of these nana for banana and wawa for waters, that's okay at age 18 months, 2 years old, right? It's when we get into age three, age four, obviously, those are not, that's when there's a delay, considerably delay. And oftentimes, not all the time, but sometimes it's a matter of practice. It's a matter of more modeling, creating more opportunities to use those words, which is why, for instance, earlier in the program when we were talking about giving more opportunities to use the word shoe, right, across a context, across environments, across partners, that's how we then work on things, right? So when we want to really shape the production of a word later on when it's appropriate for us to be actually working on instead of just playing with sounds and words, that's one way that we can do that.
Yes,
so,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much. It's been a really, really great talking to you. I appreciate you being on today.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, and do you want to give us your website so people
I'd love to
find you? Go ahead.
Yeah, so if you're interested in learning more about, early development, in particular early communication development, but of course this goes across the developmental domains, I run strengthenwords.com, which there's also a podcast and there's all kinds of great, you know, resources that are for families with infants and toddlers of all developmental levels. And I have one thing that I've developed is something that I call Strength in Words Weekly, which is a sort of a weekly email that you can get your hands on that goes, you know, straight to your inbox each week with, you know, you tell me your child's age range and I give you developmentally appropriate, you know, basic information, the sort of bite-sized nuggets, and then very, very simple, easy activities, like the kinds of, using the kinds of materials that we talked about today, things that you already have in your home to do those, to engage in those wonderful basic interactions that really do support early development, so that you don't have to, you know, worry about going onto Pinterest and thinking, I don't have any of these materials, and that you don't have to think that you have to go out and buy things to engage with your child and to do what matters most at the time that you need it. So I encourage you to come onto the Strength in Words website, and that's just strengthinwords.com, and you can find that there.
Very good.
And everything else. Yeah. Thank you. Thanks so much.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'll also put your information on the show notes for today on my website as well, so they can find it there.
Fantastic.
At the end of the show as well. I hope you enjoyed the show today. I wanted to say thank you again to Ayelet for taking the time out of her day to do this interview with me. You can find her information on my website at mymidwesttherapy.com under the show notes for this episode. Don't forget to check out my book while you're there. The book is called Play With Your Food, How to Get Your Toddler to Eat. You can check, you can click on the picture of my book from my website and it will direct you to the Amazon website. There you can read more about the book and also easily purchase it. It's a pretty quick read, just really meant to give you some things to look out for with your infants and toddlers, especially from a sensory processing point of view. Thank you so much for listening. Have a great day.